on today's Compassion Radio.
The abolition of slavery was a wonderful thing, but it wasn't nearly as important as the reformation of manners in the country. The country was completely transformed. I think the United States needs to go back and be boring for a little bit, if it can also be moral at the same time.
Intrepid.
When God tells you to go, then everything works out. He provides.
Involved.
It is so exciting to see what God can do, and this is why there is so much hope.
International.
Compassion Radio allows the listener to get involved in projects that are going to change history.
This is Compassion Radio.
Good news declared. God's love delivered. Welcome to the Daily Ministry Broadcast Journal that tells of the new thing God is doing in some of the world's toughest places. This is Compassion Radio. So glad to have you along with us right smack in the middle of November. Today, we check in with a longtime friend of this ministry whose credentials are impeccable. He's a world journalist and truly a sojourner with visionary eyes. This conversation canvasses a number of topics, so stick around for the next 25 minutes. You will be so glad that you did. Taking the reins once again, our own Bram Floria.
Friends, welcome to this edition of Compassion Radio. Now, over the years, Norm has brought to light some of the finest minds, thinkers, authors of all of Christendom. And one of those people keeps coming back to us. We respect his work. Why? Because he's an international personality. David Aikman, retired Time magazine correspondent, a retired professor, and a prolific author is with us today. David, welcome to Compassion Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on that.
David, it's been way too long since we've had you back on the program. I do apologize for that because you've had plenty of good things to say over the years, and we've read a lot of the material you produce, and you produce a lot of great fiction, which I was not expecting after the great nonfiction you wrote.
I have to let you into a secret. Virtually every reporter I've ever met dreams of being a new Tom Clancy or John Grisham.
Of course.
And wants to turn his or her experiences into the basis for an exciting thriller.
And your life has been a thriller, no doubt. Now, I've heard from other good Christian authors that that is, in fact, the very mode that they want to get into because they can tell much more truth than would seem plausible in nonfiction. We expect that nonfiction would just get to the basic facts and then let me decide. But in fiction, we're willing to enter into that suspension of disbelief, and then you can really hit it with some hard truths.
Yes, and fiction allows you freedom of space, narrative, time, to investigate the characters and the motivations of people you're writing about. And it's a much more open opportunity to explore all kinds of topics in general life than you often have with nonfiction.
And the most recent of your novels tackles some pretty big themes: our national sovereignty, our identity, the idea of civil and personal and global human rights. Describe some of the themes that you've tackled recently.
Well, the most recent thing I've done is I've reissued a novel that I originally published in 1993 about a future American Civil War. And the polarization of the country in that decade, the first decade of Bill Clinton's presidency, was really quite dramatic. And people were talking about a civil war even at that time. And in addition, Russia was becoming nationalistic after the collapse of communism. And we're seeing the same thing happening in this year. And so what I did was I reissued the book as sort of a warning of what could happen if polarization in the United States got out of hand and other countries became deeply involved in our destiny.
Now, those real-world fears that we were experiencing back in the 1990s seem almost quaint today compared to the stridency that we've seen from public figures, whether they're in politics or in media, and just the general attitude on the street. So, obviously, that's resolving itself in some ways politically this week as we record this program.
Right.
Now,
indeed,
beyond our own fears for what might happen, what do you think is at the heart of the amped up rhetoric and the animosity we're seeing within our own populace?
Well, aside from the personality background of the two major candidates in this election, Democrat and Republican, I think the Trump movement, and I'm not speaking here as a champion or a supporter of it necessarily, but just as an observer, is an expression of a sort of class revolt. I have actually written about this as the equivalent of the peasants' revolt in England in 1381, when the peasants were revolting not just against new poll taxes that had been imposed, but about the entire British class system. And I think in many respects, the current election in the United States is a grassroots revolt of what many people perceive as the class goal, the elite control of media, entertainment, education, and so forth, that has dramatically changed the character of this country in the last 50 years. So it's essentially an attempt to turn back the clock and make America a country that would be much more comfortable to the people who were flourishing before what happened in the 1960s.
Now, is it kind of a hypocritical position, though? Is it like drug addicts against their own dealers?
No, I don't think so, because part of the Trump movement, and again, I'm not speaking as a partisan or a specific supporter of it, is a feeling that the values of their country, the business dealings of their country have been turned upside down. And not by foreign conquest, but by an elite structure that controls much of the way that business is being done, that capitalism is operating, that controls education and what the culture is allowed to see for its entertainment. It's really what I call a cultural counter-revolution. But on the other hand, it's also revolutionary in the sense that many people think that the trends of American capitalism have actually become a form of cronyism, that rich people help other rich people get their corporations to grow up and eat on smaller corporations. And it's actually the opposite of democratic capitalism, because crony capitalists who decide and make happen what they think they want to happen in the country as a whole. And it's the small business people who are really edged out when you have that situation.
So from an economic lens, is it time for us to be looking more for a Teddy Roosevelt than for a direct populist?
Yes, in a way. He called himself a progressive, and the people of that era who wanted to change the heavily locked up top capitalist system in the 1890s, they really were revolting against more and more control by fewer and fewer companies over the whole economy. And that led to the progressive reforms of the Teddy Roosevelt era. And that was a time when the word progressive, I think, had quite a positive value. What's happened really since the 1960s is that the word progressive has come to signify liberal moral values or even no moral values and a secular domination of all the points of our culture that really matter when we talk about bringing up our children. And people are sometimes they're not able to articulate it, but they're really revolting against the sense that right and wrong, as it was traditionally known and accepted in the United States, thrown out a window. And we've got people telling us anything you do, if you want to do it, is absolutely right. It doesn't affect anyone else. And that moral relativism is something that's also a target of the counter-revolution. They want to change that.
Which seems to be a quandary for people of faith. We are progressive at heart because if we really truly believe that the gospel is transformational and it's going to change us from the inside out to be compassionate and sensitive to the things that move the heart of God, contrary to whatever our cultural biases might be. And we think progressively that way, that we could then live out a new life, which could have a very positive and transformative effect on our societies, our neighborhoods, our communities at large. The label has been co-opted by those who are nihilistic or relativistic in their worldview.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we are progressive in the sense that we want the kingdom of God to internally change the structure of our society. It doesn't involve organizational changes, but it involves changing the heart of our national culture. And that is where Christianity is really transformational.
Thank you for tuning in to today's edition of Compassion Radio. We're going to get you right back to the interview. Just wanted to let you know that in case you missed part of today's program, or any of our shows for that matter, you can listen back at any time that's convenient for you at CompassionRadio.com. Let's get back now to the interview.
As this program will air, the decision about who will inhabit the office will have been hopefully settled.
Right.
And then we have to move on to what's next. You have a bit of perspective over decades from outside the United States, from inside, from being a foreign-born correspondent who's now residing and living and making his life here. What would you recommend to us as citizens and as citizens of a kingdom to focus on and to pray about in the coming days?
Well, thank you for asking that. It's an important question and something that I and many friends and many Americans have been praying about for years. What this country needs is a new great awakening. Yeah. It needs a complete moral transformation. Many Americans forget that there were two great awakenings in American history.
Yes.
One in the 1740s in New England, and then another one that started around the beginning of the 19th century, let's say in 1800, that really developed powerful consequences in America's western frontier areas, completely changing the nature of how people behaved. And the second Great Awakening lasted more or less from about 1800 to 1850. That is what changed the character of the nation, made it a nation of churchgoers, of members of Christian denominations. I mean, the Methodist denomination went from a very small amount to being the majority denomination in the course of the 19th century because the Methodists were being evangelical and they were attracting converts to Christ. We need to see a complete transformation of American culture, and it has to happen at a grassroots level in every corner of society, starting with elite and then going down to the grassroots. Until we see that, I don't think we'll see a major moral change in the United States.
So it's safe to say then that a national treasure like Abraham Lincoln could not have existed without those two great awakenings.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the revolution against British control couldn't have happened without the first great awakening. And the kind of moral fiber needed to fight the Civil War and abolish slavery, and that led to the incredible presidency of Abraham Lincoln, could not have happened without the Second Great Awakening. In 1893, one of the justices of the Supreme Court, Justice Brewer, said unequivocally, "The United States is a Christian nation." He didn't mean that it had an established religion, or that everybody had to be a Christian, or that there was a faith test. What he meant was that the moral values governing the society had been shaped overwhelmingly by Christian commitment. And that is what we have to come back to if we want to really turn this country around.
Now, I can buy into that kind of definition of a Christian nation. I've been bantering back and forth with some of our guests about what it means to be a Christian nation, because my passion has been, if we truly are citizens of a kingdom, that comes preeminent.
Right.
The idea of just self-identifying as an evangelical or as a Christian in a nation that doesn't care. And we're going to the point now
right,
where it's not advantageous for us to use the moniker for any advantage. People worship, nations don't. So citizens of a kingdom have a new identity and a relationship with their king that the rest of
right,
humanity does not. Yet we
right,
have this legacy, which it seems like we are quickly vacating.
Right.
We're erasing the memory of the fact that we have such a rich and powerful legacy that has, as you said, transformed the national
right,
fabric at crucial times in history.
Well, it's important not to lose hope about this. You're absolutely correct. The legacy of the Christian moral imprint on American history and destiny has been slowly erased over a period of time. But just look back to what happened in England in around 1750. England was a very decadent country, politically corrupt with all kinds of sort of aristocratic groups controlling society. It had profound alcoholism problems. The cities of England were sort of drunken cesspools. Prostitution was on the rise, even worshipping the devil, actually, in the late 18th century.
So occultism was on the rise.
Absolutely, yeah, and it looked like a pretty hopeless case. But what had started as the Wesley Revolution had a grassroots impact that completely transformed society. And so one of the people transformed, of course, was William Wilberforce, who said that God had given him two great objects, the abolition of the slave trade and the reformation of manners in England. Now, the abolition of slavery was a wonderful thing, but it wasn't nearly as important as the reformation of manners in the country. The country was completely transformed. Business people from the continent of Europe who lived a fairly decadent lifestyle in France and Germany came to England in the 1850s and they said, my gosh, we can't flirt with the daughters of our business colleagues because the business colleagues are all at home with their families. Isn't life dull?
Oh, the horror.
The horror of a boringly moral society. Well, I think this country, the United States, needs to go back and be boring for a little bit, if it can also be moral at the same time.
The way you've described this kind of pre-Dickensian era sounds to me like exactly what places like West Virginia and most of the South and Appalachia are facing right now with the onslaught of the powerful new drugs that are
so insidious.
Oh, yes.
And are destroying people so quickly. So
it's catastrophic.
And it's not just a medical issue. You're saying it's a moral one. How do we position or frame this argument, this passionate pursuit of a moral renovation of our nation and the world, without it coming across as regressive, as being morally repugnant to those who have experienced new freedoms that they haven't experienced under the law or the Constitution? There are so many things that the law is becoming more and more agnostic or secular about, and we see them as the front lines of the cultural wars.
It's revealing that in Colorado, which legalized marijuana a couple of years ago, whenever it was, one of the district attorneys, I'm not sure of which city, made a full-fledged public statement that marijuana had led to an increase in the crime rate, an increase in family breakdown, and all kinds of social problems that are not just moral issues in the abstract, but they are issues that either hold the society together or hasten its falling apart. And our society has taken the route that more freedom is always better, allowing people to do whatever they want is good for them and good for everybody else. But the evidence doesn't support this. The evidence supports the fact that some kind of moral constraint is absolutely essential to hold society together. And we as Christian, as followers of Jesus, believe that the most powerful form of moral restraint is based upon an embrace of the gospel, an embrace of Jesus as the source of everything that's good and moral in our lives and in society's life. Now, we haven't yet convinced the majority of Americans that that is the case, but I think a majority are willing to be persuaded if we can live our lives to reflect the truth of this fact.
The country has not become convinced that we are even safe to be around.
That's true.
The narrative, of course, has been co-opted for nefarious purposes.
That's right.
But we also play into it a lot when we start defending obscene behavior simply because they're our person.
That's right. I mean, one of the reasons for the change in the narrative is the corruption of my own former profession, journalists. Journalists are or have been unwilling to repress their own bigotry against people they oppose for the sake of the traditional rule of fairness and truthfulness and objectivity, although objectivity is a very difficult word to define.
Yes.
But the only way to be a good reporter is to be truthful and fair. Now, being truthful means if you are describing the viewpoint of somebody you oppose politically or oppose for any reason, the only way you can be fair is to take down what he says about himself and his ideas, feed them back to him and say, is this what you actually believe? And that is a challenge to truthfulness. And many journalists are simply not ready to suppress their own opposition and bigotry to views they don't like, to be fair about what's happening in the country at large.
It seems like they jump straight to editorial rather than summing up and accurately representing what has been told them.
That's right, yes. I mean, they immediately jump to a viewpoint that people might share or disagree with, but they don't have a right to and claim to be fair and truthful.
We have to roll this over to another program. We can't stop now. If you'd be willing to bear with me, David.
Sure, absolutely, yes.
Thank you. Again, David Aikman. We're thankful to have him with us again on Compassion Radio. We'll be back tomorrow.
Well, that wraps up part one of Bram's conversation with David Aikman. Looking forward to hearing more of his insights tomorrow. As we wind things down for today, a word now from Cher Nelson.
Those of you who are longtime listeners know that for many, many years, we've had an annual project of raising money for Bibles for China. And we've always done it over Christmas, and we are doing the project again this year, but now we're doing it for Christmas. The pastor shepherd of thousands of house churches to whom our Bibles are going to go has asked if we could get the Bibles to him in time this year to give to people at Christmas. Well, we're delighted to do so, but now we hope that your Christmas spirit is available this early to make that possible. For $6, you can place a Bible in the hands of a Christian family who is just aching for one. We know that for every Bible we place, and there are other members in the family who will have access to that Bible, that there will be four or five people come to know Christ just through the placement of one Bible. We know that there are 20,000 to 30,000 new Christians in China every day, so we know how great the need is. Now, can you get in your Christmas spirit, and can you help us to get the Bibles to China for Christmas this year? Also, as you've heard us tell you year after year, there are well over 100,000 Chinese missionaries that are moving out across the ancient Silk Road trade routes to take back all of that Islamic territory for Jesus Christ. They understand that this Back to Jerusalem movement could help stop extremist Muslim terrorism right in its tracks. And as you probably know, we also believe that that is the only answer to terrorism and Islamization, the gospel of Jesus Christ.
We depend 100% on listeners like you to carry out our calling. And in a very real sense, this is your ministry. Whatever is done through Compassion Radio is what you make possible. I'm asking you, send your best gift today. It is tax deductible, and Compassion Radio is a member in good standing of the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. That's important because that certification is your guarantee that we meet the highest standards of financial integrity. Thanks so much, my friend, for standing with us here at Compassion Radio.
For as little as $6, you can place a copy of God's Word, the Bible, into the hands of a Chinese believer who's desperate for his or her own copy. $60 provides 10 Bibles, $90 provides 15 Bibles, and so on. Call today, 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. Our address, Compassion Radio, P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And we're online at CompassionRadio.com. Finally, just to add a little extra encouragement for you, if you call in with your gift of $30 or more before the 15th of November, we have a special Christmas gift we will send out to you. So make your call today. Your gifts will help us deliver Bibles to Pastor Daniel in China for Christmas gifts for his believers. And if you would like to give your gift in someone's name, call and request a gift certificate to give to that person at Christmas commemorating your gift in their name. Please call us at 1-800-868-2478, and we will send them to you. That's 1-800-868-2478. Reach us by mail at Compassion Radio, Post Office Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And you can always pay us a visit at our safe and secure website, CompassionRadio.com. Before we go, here's a special reminder for our friends who listen to Compassion Radio.
We consider it a privilege to share God's Word with you and stories of Christ's accomplishments here each day. The Lord has allowed us to partner together and minister the good news and compassion of Jesus Christ. Toward that end, your financial support right now will determine the future of Compassion Radio here in this area. Call or write to us now with your gift. Your involvement means the world to us. Thanks again for your support. Our toll-free number, 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address once again, Post Office Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And online, as always, at CompassionRadio.com. I'm Jim Governale. On behalf of Dr. Norman Cher Nelson, Bram Floria, and the team, have a wonderful day in the Lord. And we'll see you again tomorrow for the next Compassion Radio.